and welcome to Quality of Life Radio, hosted by Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazines.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Big Blend Radio's Quality of Life show with Nancy and Lisa. And today we're excited to welcome, well, we're going to play Doctor. You know, why not?
Hello.
Dr. John Lawrence joining us, and he's going to talk about his latest medical memoir. It's called Playing Doctor, Part 2, Residency. Now we want the first one. Nancy's been reading it, and she's read the book, and now she wants the first one. And
That's
the way we roll here. We go backwards first. But anyway, it is a book. If you know, you're going to go to the doctor, read this first. Check it out. It's out December 27th, 2022. Go to Dr. Lawrence's website. It's johnlawrencewriter.com, and that's Lawrence with an L-A-W, so he's got a little law in there. So how are you, Dr. John?
Great to be here.
I thought you would play music for us, you know.
But, you said, well, Dr. John used to be my nickname in my acting class. Everybody calls me Dr. John. It's kind of tapping into my energy. It's so nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Hey, this is great. Nancy loves your book. We love the cover too. I mean, that is so funny.
That's thanks to Carolyn Johnson, my designer. She's fantastic. So very fortunate to have met her through a book service that helps you match authors with publicists or designers and editors. So got very lucky to meet her.
Awesome. And you know, you have the best book publicist on the planet, right? Books Forward. I have to give them a shout out. Listen, they've been with us. We've been working together since the beginning of time. I'm just saying, I got to give them a shout out. I love them. They're awesome.
Absolutely.
But they really are. But this is interesting because you've got acting, film, writing, screenwriting. You've done all kinds of careers. You're talking about river rafting, bagel baking, all kinds of things. But becoming a doctor, what led you to the world of deciding to become a doctor?
Convoluted answer. The true answer is, I think, crazier than just saying it was it's a nice way to go help people. But I that's covered a bit in book one, so I will get that to both of you. I had originally actually thought about going to law school. I wanted to work in environmental issues and work in conservation, politics, and ended up doing some internships in law firms, big corporate law firms that just didn't seem very happy at the time. So my career advisor, who I told the only thing I didn't want to be was a doctor, basically I said, you know, maybe I'll think about this medicine thing. He said, you know, I get hurt a lot. So sounds like I could be a doctor. You get to go to the doctors a lot when, you know, playing sports. So he said, well, you might want to think about it a little bit more than that. Sounds like maybe you're jumping careers. And so I was going through all sorts of different things. As you mentioned, working as a river guide, and I was a ski guide, and I met a French doctor, and we talked about Doctors Without Borders, and it really perked my interest. You could do a lot of really great work. Medicine you can use around the world. I could work part-time and then pursue all the other things I didn't want to let go of either. So it was kind of I get to do some work that I think would be very valuable to me and to other people, but also allow me to pursue living in different places, pursue other writing things that interested me. So that's the short answer.
But that's a long career. I mean, that's a hard grind becoming a doctor.
Yeah. I probably didn't read the
fine print
too well. But it was it is interesting because that was almost one of the things that held me back mentally, thinking when you know exactly what you're going to do, it's going, okay, I know my career path now. For the next, once I was accepted, I was actually working when I started a company promoting environmental products to different countries and governments, and was and I came back. I was living in Poland, and I got back with this interview. I thought I got accepted, and all of a sudden I was thinking, well, I know what I'm doing for the next 8-10 years. You're going to be in school, you're going to be here for 4 years, then you're going to do a residency for another 4 years. So having that much of your life mapped out was a little bit intimidating. And then at the same time, once you're in it, there's so many dynamic and exciting fun things that happen too. So
commitment, it's a big commitment, you know, to get in there. And from the, you know, the other side of the coin, like, you know, going to a doctor, that to me is one of the scariest things to do. No, like, I have to be like, you know, if
drunk,
everybody said, yeah, I'm dead, dying.
I've definitely had patients show up drunk. Now I know where it's coming from.
Nancy has basically read your book to me, like everyone. Now he said this, and you know, and yeah. Talking about, she said that women go to the doctor more than men, from what you were writing about.
It was, I think she's probably referring to a passage. Sometimes getting men to admit why they're there is a lot more difficult. Sometimes getting patients just to tell you why they're actually in your office, it sounds like it should be pretty straightforward, but it just wasn't. You spent a lot of your time trying to actually find out what's the real reason you're here. Why, you know, they come in with one reason, but then you get into the deeper things. And women, again, huge generalization, of course, but women tended to be a little bit more upfront. Is this what I want treated today? And men would come in and I'd say, what are you here for today? Well, my wife made me come in.
Yeah.
So that doesn't help me whatsoever. I still don't know why you're here.
That would be me. I'm the female, but I would not be. But that, you know, going to the doctor and having all, I think there is
scary.
There's a gap between the medical world and then the patient world or non-patient. And when things happen and things do go wrong and there's disease, and we took care of my step-grandfather when he had a stroke when we lived in Mexico. None of us knew what anybody was doing. He's partially deaf. He spoke Guernseyese, as I say, so everything's oi. And that wasn't what was going on. And none of us knew what was going on. This was way back when.
I had no idea what was happening.
I got to this point of like, you have to write everything down and you have to have someone with you, because it's almost like you go to see a doctor and it's like, you have this and goodbye.
That's very accurate, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I think you're right. There's it's too bad that it's intimidating, because when I wrote the book and people ask who the audience is, I think, well, everybody's been to the doctor. Yeah. Everybody's either been there with a parent, with a child, with yourself. You've had an experience from the beginning to the end of your life. You're going to get sick. So I think part of it is, we, as you mentioned, when you go to the doctor, it's most cases, especially in this, you know, in the US, it's because you're sick. You don't go to the doctor usually for many preventative, maybe, you know, kids, we try to, but you're already going in a stressful situation. You're not well, you're spending money, you know, you're doing all these things and you want the doctor to treat you. And the doctors are on the other side working on, I've been told by a corporation, I need to see this many patients, do it quickly. Here's what you have. Here's a diagnosis. And it was very, I came to medicine with a slightly different view in some ways, just because I had some head injuries. So I had some amnesia. I wasn't going to be the sharpest tack in the box, but I could listen. That was, I think, you know, when people compliment me on being a good doctor, it was because I was willing to listen and hear why they're there and take time. So I always ran behind schedule because I did want to take time, which eventually led to me opening a clinic where we would spend, you know, an hour with each patient. You want to spend time and do that. And I hope in my books, what I've had a lot of when I've gone to book clubs, a lot of people say is, you know, help me realize the doctors are just people too, and they want feedback. They want to talk and connect. And you're right. I think both sides enter with this tension and friction that runs counter to what's best for both sides. So hopefully that will change. I know a lot of people would like to see it improve.
You know, you need that time to, especially if it's a new doctor and they don't know you and you don't know them, there's this you know, and you don't have it's not like having a drink in a bar where you can relax and then tell everybody.
We want a margarita bar.
You're onto something. I think we need a bar in the front of the office, right?
A bar would be great.
Yeah. Everybody relax. I used to joke when you go to sew somebody up with these little metal shot glasses where you put the saline to wash, and they'd look over at me. They would say, "What's that? What's that?" And I'd say, "That's the scalpel or the needle." And then I'd look at that and like, "Oh, that's for me. I need a quick drink before we start." So,
there we go.
Kidding, because some of those needles, come on, can't we do it with shorter needles? Really? Seriously?
You've had some traumatic experiences.
Well, there's a lot of fear. There is,
absolutely.
And I think that's the hardest part. And to me, then I just get the giggles. That's it. I'm out. And good luck. You know, you're going to try and jab me while I'm like,
it's a serious relationship though. And there's a different energy with each patient, with each doctor, and you enjoy it when you can feel people relax. And I feel like that was my role as a physician, was, you know, with parents, to try to let them relax. If I'm taking care of their children and going to try to sew them back up, there's so much tension and fear involved in your health and your well-being or your relatives. So you're right. There's a lot of emotions underneath everything of what's happening, and how different people handle it becomes very interesting. I used to laugh and say, oh my goodness, you can't imagine. Anyway, every delivery when you're in the delivery room is so different. The emotions and the energies, you can see how people feed off each other. It's just, you know, this fascinating environment that you could create a sitcom based on each different delivery was so interesting. And how
is that what's happening with you now? Is that what's going to happen? Because you write
maybe,
a film.
Maybe.
Yeah. You know,
going back to when I was a kid, the doctors made house calls and it wasn't so traumatic. Now you have to go to the doctor as post. And so that's more traumatic. And then you sit with other sick people, which feed off of each other. And you wait however long, 20 minutes to an hour, sometimes longer. And then by the time you get into the doctor's office, then you sit on the little funny bed and you wait another 20 minutes.
And the little thing over you. Where you know that.
And by the time the doctor gets there, you're a basket case. I'm done, dude.
Believe me, I'm a different person on the patient side than the the doctor side. I think I tell the story in the third book when I went, we've decided we had three kids. That was enough time to get me taken for, you know, to get neutered. And I showed up at the urologist and they write that part where you write down, what are you here for?
Yeah.
And I could not remember the name of the vasectomy for the life of me. I sat there for minutes just going, I know this word. I think my mind just put a blank on it. I was like, this is so tense. I cannot think of it.
Yeah. You didn't say I need to get neutered.
No, I think I wrote down, I need the procedure where you make sure we don't have any more kids. That's what I wrote down.
Well, no, listen, when Nancy gave birth to me, Nancy tried to get me circumcised.
Yeah, I did. Because my mom kept saying, no matter what, if it's a boy, get it circumcised. And I didn't, I'm like, all I could say is circumcise it.
You had some good drugs, I suppose. But yeah, part of why you wrote, you know, playing doctor, your book, and obviously a series. So we're at part two now. You've got part one, three's coming out. Is this part of that to connect the patients and the doctors, the two worlds together?
Yeah, it was. So when I originally wrote what became the books, these started out, you know, pre-blog era. Email had been invented. So I was sending emails out to friends when I was on call. And I would just write these really, like I said, I had a really different view of medicine. I didn't come in with I was planning to be this noble doctor since I was born. I really came at it and just had this kind of open view. I can't believe they let me in. And it was really just entertaining to see all the stories and everything as you're trying to survive and you're working so hard and just watching all the fun and the chaos. And so at 3 a.m, I'd just have a few spare minutes waiting for some labs to show up. And I'd write these email missives to a group of friends to kind of just, you know, like you're sitting around the bar sharing stories of this is what happened today, or, you know, let's, you know, just. And years later, a friend said, hey, I kept a bunch of your emails. I'd love to publish them. And I just kind of threw out the quip. I was like, don't, I'll just write the whole thing. And the next day I sat down and just started writing start to finish. You know, and luckily friends had collected the emails. I had shoe boxes of notes of just what patients had said, of funny little statements of the stories that I'd had. And so I wrote this huge 700-page manuscript. And it sat there. I didn't do anything with it. And I'd go back and tweak things. And then I had a TV show I really was excited. I thought was going to get picked up. We talked to we thought it was going to move forward. And after all 6 months of putting a lot of time into it, some producers in Hollywood convinced my partner at the time. He just said, you know, this isn't going to work. You know, period pieces don't work well on TV. Like, what do you, don't listen to one person. Come on. I mean, granted, they're much smarter in the industry than I am. And I just needed a project to finish. I felt like I needed to complete something. So I looked at that huge 700 page tome that I figured nobody would pick up and figured, why don't I divide it into some smaller books and I could do. And so I just focused on that and got the first book out and then now the second and third.
Cool. Well, I'm sorry they didn't do the TV show.
It's going to happen. It's still awesome. A dream project.
Things change. Yeah. You know.
The next, once the third book's out, back to screenwriting and movie making and then going for this project. I randomly found out it takes place in the 11th century and my mother-in-law did a little bit of like genealogy type stuff and she just sent it to me. I was like, oh, this is interesting. How interesting. I'm going back. Oh, look at this. This is funny. And also, wait a second. This is who I'm writing about. This book that I'm trying to get the rights to is about our kids. So I'm like, our kids are related to it. This is a sign. I must make this happen.
That's weird.
It remains the dream project.
That's weird. Yeah.
It's gonna be great.
That's cool. That's well, so you've got this creativity, obviously, right? And attention to detail to be able to do it. And then the creativity and obviously the communication skills. So being a doctor and going through, I don't even to go to that whole educational process, that's like a massive commitment. But do you think the creativity helped you as a doctor be able to diagnose and then also communicate, to be able to change communication?
That's a really great question.
Because to me, it's like when we talk to people, they can say, okay, this person doesn't want to talk. Okay, let's prod around a little bit until we find the hot spot. You know what I mean?
Right. Everybody has a story. That's one thing you certainly realize. And certainly, like you said, once you crack it, suddenly you can't stop them talking at times.
Right.
I was going to say the creativity helped me survive. You know, I'd be off producing plays and acting in plays, and all my staff or patients would see me, you know, in a dress acting silly in some comedy or a Neil Simon comedy. And for me, it was just the place to put the other side of your brain and just, you know, release all this fun tension. But in terms of the patient and doctoring, there might have been the communication and being able to just, you know, open your mind up to, you know, like you said, a lot of doctors say, boom, this is your diagnosis. Yeah. And I learned, first of all, we're all going to make mistakes. So I never was, you know, I just wasn't a dogmatic thinker in a lot of ways, but I was more, okay, you know, what am I missing? I need to talk to somebody else. You know, who else, what else can I think through wise? You know, if you want to communicate with somebody, and that was what I've talked about. I had a blog, I think I wrote this, saying, you know, the most important skill is listening. They teach. I was very fortunate. I have wonderful teachers throughout my medical training. And they would drum into your head. The number one reasons doctors get sued is not because they made a mistake. It's because the patients felt they weren't listened to. And right. That was, you know, even if there was a mistake, as long as the patient felt the doctor actually communicated and listened and, you know, they felt, hey, they did what they thought was best, or, you know, it just didn't work out as well. So it is important, but even in acting, it's important you listen to the other person you're acting with. Otherwise you can tell it's not right. But there's different lessons that overlap each other, I'm sure.
Well, I think the listening is huge, because
it's huge, because if you don't feel listened to, it's easy to throw barbs at the other person.
Yeah. You already think like, oh, there's no attention to detail. There's no quality control. There's no caring. There's no checking. So if there is a mistake, it's like, you're just being pushed in the funnel. You're you know, part of that industry. That's where, you know, we even say medical industry. When did it become industry? Is that
the family industry? I was going to say, think about in our most intimate relationships, right? There's entire podcasts and books on how to communicate with people you know well. And even then they say, like, sometimes you have to repeat back, this is what I heard you say. Is that right? And most of the time we're way off. We're not even close because we're so in our heads.
Now, if I do that to Nancy, she goes, stop with your mumbo jumbo. Like, she's like, you're doing your psychologist stuff. It doesn't work.
Don't do that.
I don't know anything about psychology, but I just do that just out of, you know.
Well, sometimes you check in, right? And you're going,
you have to just, this is what I, you know, heard you say. And you're just like, that's not what I said. Oh, well, then let's start again. You know, but the communication, that is it. If people are not heard, and then when it comes to your body, I mean, it is a scary thing.
Yeah.
There are also times where I've had my arm all mangled and refixed, and that was one of the scariest things in my life because of my phobia of I've had instances, and I've got a real reason to be scared of doctors. And when I was a little kid, and I thought
they tried to circumcise you. That's your first
thing. Well, don't forget she her water broke while she was watching The Exorcist.
The Exorcist.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, I'm not.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to use that.
I know, and I wouldn't leave until I saw the rest of the movie. And then I woke up thinking, no, it's good. She's going to twist her head around and spit at people.
But yeah, and then I came out talking, apparently. So
I know. I don't know. But she said it's the first child he delivered that actually was trying to,
I didn't
speak,
want the slap.
And I'm like, no, I'm out of here, man.
I knew I didn't want the slap, but there's when we were in Kenya, and I was a little kid, I was playing with my friends, and down the hill from us was the country club, and they had swings and everything. Gosh. And we're like, well, let's go play. And they're like, no, because they're black, I'm white. And they're like, you know, hi. And I'm like, no, they're swings. If they're swings, they're for kids. We're kids. Yeah. So over the barbed wire fence we go, and we're swinging and carrying on. And then here comes the guard swinging a machete and chases us. Yeah. And so now what do? I get the giggles. I get the giggles at funerals. I get the giggles in every inappropriate place. They're gone. They know about running. I get the giggles and decide to giggle my way over the barbed wire fence and cut my stomach open. Not bad. Oh, like, goodness. You know, stitches. Next thing you know, I'm in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And I'm freaking out. Like, these people are controlling my body. And this hand goes over my mouth to, like, you're going to shut. And I freaked out, you know. So this is, I know it's where this all started, this fear of medicine and the white coat. Like, they need to stop it. The white coat is stupid. They should take that and tie-dye it.
I stopped wearing it as soon as I could. I had, like, such a bad ring around the collar. I hated that coat.
It is just, it's so, like, it because you have
it's
no
clinical.
I think and what scared me was
you just didn't put all your books as a student. That's why they had the coat. But
it's really high. The white thing is like we're the kings and queens, and I don't know. It's just this. It's almost like it is like the hierarchy of control over your body as a patient. That's what it is. It's like they're going to control your body, and I have a complete freak out about it. And if there's no communication, when they went to do my arm, they were going to put me under, and I'm going, what if I wake up? What do I do if I wake up under when I'm under? You know, nobody would tell me next thing I'm out. But I freaked out. I had like a full-on panic attack. Was what if I wake up? Do I get to talk? Is there a signal? I just want to know. Do I, you know, flip someone?
Very, very common concern.
And no one tells you. Mm-hmm. So you're freaking out. Why don't they just say, here, do this? You know, at least, I don't know.
Her orthopedic surgeon that fixed her arm, I'm in the waiting room. He just walks over. He doesn't say who he is. He just pats me on the shoulder and he goes, it's a handful. And I'm like, oh God, what did you do in there?
But this is where the communication and fear, and it is about, I think, some people are fine with it. They want to go to the doctor all the time. And I'm like, dude, but it is about control and that fear of control. So when we lived in Mexico, I went to our dentist and he had to do a root canal. And now here we go again, freak out. But he explained everything to me, whereas some people don't want to know what's going on. But once I knew exactly what he was doing, go ahead. It was miserable, but go ahead and do it. And he did put a hummingbird stained glass thing up on his window so that I could calm down. Because I was like, you need some color in this office. Stop with the white. And he did it so I could look at the hummingbird. But it was that was what I was trying to say. That was a big long story. Just to say the two differences of approach, he spent time and listened and answered my questions. So then I felt heard, but I actually knew what was happening to my body, where the other times you don't understand. And you got to think pre-Google. Now we have Google, which is dangerous too.
It's very dangerous. I still laugh. Every patient that came in, they'd come in. I was like, as soon as you go down the Google rabbit hole, you're going to end up with cancer. No matter what you come in with.
Exactly. We're all dying.
Pretty much.
And go put a crystal on your forehead or something. I don't know. But that's what I think is so important about what you're doing, writing books, is it humanizes the experience because it feels inhuman.
And it needs it.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate. You know, I think there certainly is a difference sometimes just even in the United States on, again, very general, gross generalizations of, let's say some of the East Coast and these hospitals that are very strict and have, a more dogmatic approach, let's say, or some of the other, the big hospitals all around the country, compared to, I think there are other plenty of places. I've had so many doctors who I think are, like I said, they teach you need to communicate, and they want you to, you have to listen. And it's almost, I joke about it, but they're almost trying to teach you emotional intelligence, which you think should be somewhat innate, but just trying to say, you need to learn to communicate to the patients. And, like in your case, as you mentioned, some people like to hear everything. Some people like to know exactly what's going to happen. Other people will tell you right away, I don't want to know anything. Just do it. I don't want to know. If I know, I'll freak out. Everybody's different, and every approach was its own story unfolding in front of you. And
What's it like going and actually being residency for as an intern? Was that exciting? Was it scary? Suddenly the first time you have to inject somebody, what's that?
It's a wide mix of the intern year was just a blur because you, in some ways, and I'll speak to other doctors about it. A lot of medicine especially in the past, was kind of routine and boring because half of it's writing notes. You're nonstop. You know, as the intern, especially, you have to just do all the notes, all the writing. Mm. You don't get to do the fun. I won't say the word, the P word, as we talked about. Our listeners won't know what we're talking about. when you had to do an injection or something else of that sort.
The procedure.
There we go. I didn't want to say it. I knew you were going to. So you, as the intern, you're really running around seeing the patients, doing all the interviews that, you know, while the other doctors get to do the fun procedures and things like that. But it was every step of the way, kind of like parenting. It's like, you know, parenting is you really just jump in. In medical school, you're a little bit more of an observer. You might get to do a little bit here and there. They might let you put a few sutures in, but you're really shadowing and watching and trying to learn, even in the clinical rotations. And then you're thrown in your intern year, and it is a little bit shocking. And they'll say it's the biggest learning curve in medicine, just because you go from being a medical student. At the end of the year, you're supposed to be a junior doctor and working, taking care of patients. So it's an overwhelming amount to learn and take in and suddenly be responsible for. You always say, but you still have your senior resident. You have an attending physician who's over you. So there's always somebody to turn to, but you don't want to because you have so much work to do. Nobody else has a lot of spare time either. So if anything, it's just the intern year felt like a mountain of work. You know, my surgical resident friends in their intern year, they were just beyond exhausted. You know, they would just tell me stories of, just collapsing at the hospital, collapsing inside their doorway when they got home and waking up a few hours later and going back to the hospital. They couldn't make it to their bed. It was sheer level of exhaustion. But
that's crazy.
The patient stuff, you still learn. I mean, it's in a way, it's an apprenticeship. But even after I finished residency, you know, you're out in your practice and you're still calling up other doctors asking for advice. You're still looking at books or making sure you're doing it right. There's just, I think there's such intense pressure to do it right, to do your best, to make sure to review and go, wait, I know I've done this, 20 times. I've done this exact thing, in the last weeks. I've done this many times, but let me just one more time, make sure I'm doing everything the right way. I think doctors have a lot of pressure doctors are so caring. The ones I know, they put so much effort into their patients.
But isn't it different every single patient, even if you're doing the same procedure?
Absolutely.
Everybody's a little different inside.
Yep. I mean, and it goes all the way from, that's why you'll say you want to go to the person that's done that surgery the most. You know, you go to them because they're comfortable. When it turns a little bit different, they've seen it all. They know how to do things. But that's what comes with time and practice. And I think the intern, the residency years are just the beginning of your training. I mean, I think most doctors would say they continue to learn and learn throughout their careers. And medicine itself advances so rapidly in the last years, changes in treatments, changes in medicines, realizing, wait, we can do this better. So you're constantly having to review and keep up and learn, you'd hope.
That's what it's so important. You know, we talk about science and science, we still have a problem in this world of understanding science and listening and understanding that science is always changing. I mean, we're always learning stuff about, this was the oldest dinosaur, and then we'll find out, no, this is the oldest dinosaur.
Right.
So we're always changing with what our discoveries are. And so when we learn something new, we embrace it, look at it, but it's not like one scientist saying, that's it, everybody, this is how it is. Isn't it like when we talk about science or medical science, someone will write a paper, everybody goes, yeah, no, yes, no. You know what I mean? Isn't there like a group when we're talking changes in how a procedure is done, or hey, a vaccine is created, or all of that?
Absolutely.
Right? There's a team of people like playing good cop, bad cop, right?
Yeah, you're giving me some horrible memories of my board exams when they get into asking you statistical questions and evidence-based medicine. But you're right. They really do try to teach you how to read journals with an objective eye. And that's a super important part of medicine. In a way, especially I think Western medicine wants to be dogmatic and say, here is the paper, here is the one that we've agreed, evidence-based medicine says this is the way you should treat everybody. But even then, there's times I'm saying, well, I know that's what the book says, but I've seen this so many times that this works better. I've seen my patients do well if I do it this way. So there is, it's not a black and white situation. I mean, I think most of medicine turns into, I say most, I mean, there are certainly situations. Somebody has a certain infection, let's get them on some antibiotics that treat it in most cases. Or you cut your arm off, I think we should sew it back on. This is how we're going to reattach it. Or how we, there's some There's a thing, you know, when you mangle your arm, that's what they do. But yeah, but it comes down, you're getting up to like really the upper levels of thought of how does the whole practice of medicine evolve and mm-hmm. properly. And it's a very conservative field. So they do put a lot of thought into, okay, is this paper correct and why? And was the study correct? Do they have enough people to make it? You know, there's so many different ways you can bias a study. Pharmaceutical companies are notorious for.
Oh, that's what's interesting too. Mm-hmm. Don't they come around and try to like the whole commercials, like the TV commercials and the radio commercials, you can't, and it's especially amazing. The radio cracks me up because
it was the other day. I was dying laughing to some of the stuff they said.
Blah, 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 blah.
It is. Oh, it's really funny. And then
Donnie
all
Deutsch's
these
fault.
People playing tennis and all this stuff. And then
you
try
could
this, try that. And
take this for constipation, but you may die from constipation.
Yeah. Right. I know. When you use the side effects of the drug to exactly what you already have.
They are entertaining. I mean, to their credits, they do a lot of research in good areas. And you certainly have people, I know friends who have MS who have said, oh my goodness, you know, the pharmaceutical companies really help them, you know, help them become spokespersons for the company and the research they put into certain disease. And on the other side, you hear these stories of how some of these companies have started promoting and advertising the diseases that they're going to have drugs for 2 years ahead of time before they release the drug. So they almost make us aware of the illness so that we're ready for the drug to show up. It's like, man, we live in a business, like you said, in an industry.
It is a business.
So the body is interesting though, right? I mean, it really is. We're like a walking thing of water and gas with a few bones floating around in there. You know, when you think about what our bodies are, I mean, that has got to be interesting as a doctor, like everybody's body, like you get to see everybody's bodies in a way, you know, it's kind of like.
You do get to see a lot of bodies inside
you know?
And out.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
But I think
different. Most people, the more, like everything else, you've both traveled and lived in so many areas mm-hmm. that when you spend time anywhere, I think you realize you appreciate the beauty even more than somebody who mm-hmm. visits. Yeah. And mm-hmm. I think doctors, the more you understand it, sometimes I remember in medical school, it's going, oh my goodness, you didn't realize how does this work? You cannot believe how elegant of us this
it's
design
amazing.
Is that it works, that we without, you know, we mess things up ourselves, but it's amazing
it's
that we
quite
keep ourselves
amazing.
In homeostasis, that we balance ourselves and mm-hmm. stay healthy. It's truly wondrous. You know, that you can have a child, that they can actually grow and be, you know, as many of them
survive
come out
that.
Healthy. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. So it really is amazing.
It.
Yeah.
It's a really odd system.
Yeah. The magic of life is pretty astounding. And what's fascinating
more efficient
to me is
motor
like
than any engine we can create. Our brains can associate things faster than, you know, until recently mm-hmm. the computers could do, you know, it's really this amazing
and
design.
Everything's connected. If you look at nature, does that ever, like, because I know you're into nature and the environment and being outside, when you look at like animals, do you ever kind of compare them to human animals? Well, I mean, because
I'm laughing because on my very on one side of my brain I feel like everything is connected in this world. We are
right.
As bodies of energy, we're connected. And then you'll talk about, do you notice comparisons in our animals? And I think I actually mentioned in the third book, I remember when one of my dogs ended up hurting their ACL in their knee. And I was like, wait, dogs have ACLs? I had no idea. You know, completely flabbergasted. They have knees. You know, you just think it's a dog leg. You don't realize, of course, they have, you know, a similar design.
Yeah.
So.
But I mean, as you're studying, did you get more and more like, wow, look at this. We can do this. I mean, it's like, you know what I mean? I would be like wanting to do science experiments on myself. Like, doctor, you know, because it is interesting. Jeez. Like, even when you go to the doctor when you're a kid and then they knock your knee and your knee flies up, your leg uh-huh. you know, flies up. I always
that's
thought,
the
well,
weirdest
that's pretty cool.
Feeling.
I would do it before you go to the doctor, do it myself. Just to
check, make sure it's working.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to fail
just
the test.
See if
don't
want to
fail that
further.
Test. No, they kick you out.
Top it. Just boom.
Yeah.
Put you back a grade.
But I mean, it is pretty amazing. But going through that whole art, I mean, to me, you know, we have Dr. Jackie Ubani. She's on our show. She's a cardiologist and she's taught mm-hmm. me how to say electrophysiologist. And we have some interesting conversations because it is really amazing what the body is. But then it's like, it's going to change. And I wonder, is it going to be different when you say, okay, well, you'll see, do a procedure and it's working this way for you. So you're finding more luck. Is it going to even be regionally? Could that happen to bodies like everything you've studied, and then you'll go and see, okay, maybe this is a regional thing. We're all, you know, drinking the same water or something, and we're all like, I don't know.
I wonder about that. There's a host of different answers there where if you're related to like different areas, we look at environmental exposures. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I've seen it happen where you'll go, we had a few cases in a row where people had been diagnosed with thyroid disorders. Mm-hmm. And you say, this is almost strange. You just moved down to this area in Southern Utah. And oh, you don't have filtered water. You're just getting water out of you've been drinking the tap water. You should have that analyzed. You know, turns mm-hmm. out a whole bunch of environmental issues in the water. As soon as they had a proper system put in to filter the water, their thyroid issues completely resolved. Now, that's you know, you can look at regional areas where how, you know, that's why people should realize what we put into our body. I think, you know, we get to food and water and nutrients, probably the most important aspect of how we can take care of ourselves. And that's in so many ways. And luckily, this is certainly being more and more recognized in the last few years. We used to try to preach this and instruct it, and now medical schools, you know, have more on top of nutrition. So you know, that's one very specific part of regional. I don't think I've seen as much. Okay, these people's bodies differ based on region, but when you work in a certain area, you know, I was able to start recognizing, oh, I know this is the recommended antibiotic for this, but this has not been working. And you just mentally start, I think, subconsciously even just saying, well, there must be resistance. I've seen this work better. I know that's what you like, or that might be the drug of choice currently, but I've seen too much of it not work. I've seen this one work better. So you have to also make your own, you know, learn and judgments and recognize in your area what's working. And they try to, especially now with computer models, they can try to help you understand where that's happening and what you should be doing. But what you see in your own clinic and your own population is certainly, that's the reality versus the computer model or the recommendation.
But even the computer model and everything now, hasn't that kind of changed also from when you first went into
absolutely.
Study?
It's a different world. A that's why I'll put a lot of that in air quotes and go, you know, the stuff they're doing now, and certainly as I think we've all seen, everybody's now an epidemiological expert and viral expert in the world, but there's, you know, being able to map the changes that are happening, whether it's, you know, variants in viruses or where they're spreading, it's, you know, fortunately we have ways of trying to chart these things. So yeah, it's changed a lot.
When we left this country and we went halfway around the world to live in Kenya, it took some time to adjust to the food and the water. It really did. I mean, and this was, you know, there wasn't really a lot of bottled water at this time. So we would boil
that's
the water.
That's not necessarily good.
You know, well, because that's what I was told to do is boil the water. So, you know, and then eventually you'd get tired of doing that. And then you would just drink the water and then you go, okay, I'm going to boil it from now
on. Well, water is amazing. Gets used to it. Yeah.
Yeah, because there are dietary things. And even just, you know, when you go shop at the city market and bring the food back and wash it, there were still differences, you know. And then eventually you got to learn, well, okay, if you're worried about the water supply and the water is watering the lettuce and you eat the lettuce, there's going to be a changeover eventually. Yeah. You're either going to get used to it or you're not. You know, and you just had to deal with it.
And you're going to get the toilet paper epidemic.
There's a lot of toilet papers.
All comes back to toilet paper shortages.
Are we back to that again?
We are, once again. We've come full circle.
It's weird because, like, even as we travel, when we go to the house, and I'll go, like, is it okay to drink the water here? You know, we were in Michigan, and we were
Flint is just a few hours
from us. How far does, you know, Hinckley, California is having the whole thing over again. So it is the environmental side. That's what I was fascinating about, because, you know, it's like, I always want to see, like, if doctors all around the world, like, okay, what are you seeing in your office? Who's coming in with what, you know, to kind of get all that information of what's going on in the world. But you've done like over 20 years, had your own clinic and all of your practice. So now you've retired from that, but not really, right? You can still run out and go and be a doctor, right?
Yeah, I keep that on the lowdown. I do try to more to help out friends. I used to joke that was the only reason I got my medical degree, was to be able to help friends if they needed it. But I did after 20 years. I ran urgent care clinics. I was the medical director of an urgent care clinic, privately owned group for a number of years. And then with a friend, we opened a clinic together. He was an acupuncturist and he had already had his own clinic. We opened another one together that was more based around, it was called East-West Health. And he had created kind of this mindset of let's combine. He's an Eastern, he's trained in Oriental medicine. I was trained in Western medicine. And so we really focused on things like brain health and gut health and really, but everybody who came into us, we would try to do a complete, look at the whole body and got into a lot of regenerative medicine, working with stem cells and exosomes and, seeing some really amazing treatments. And after that, I'd been working on this book, on films, I'm working on some different businesses with friends and having kids. I was being stretched a little bit thin. So as I kind of slowly weaned myself away from the clinic and have been working on some different projects, including the writing, but still involved with health. And one of the things we look at now is we're creating some solutions where we can help hopefully monitor people with anxiety and depression of different ages and different groups around the world. So that there's a way of maybe becoming alert, giving objective alerts to their providers, to, even in your business that, hey, this person's in danger of burning out. Can we intervene sooner? Help them, make sure that we're staying
that's
well.
That's awesome.
Is anxiety and depression caused by dietary concerns or is it really emotionally and mentally and not food wise?
Yes. I say that jokingly. There are many different aspects of what can cause anxiety, depression, and I'm not an expert, but yes, when it comes to the gut, we do know that a lot of the hormones and chemicals in your brain, let's say when you start dealing with serotonin and dopamine, people take serotonin type medicines for depression, let's say Prozac, most and those keep higher levels of serotonin in your brain. What we've learned is that a lot of serotonin actually gets developed in your or produced in your gut. So if your gut's not healthy, you can't produce as much serotonin as you need. And there's a connection between the gut and the brain. So if we can get our guts healthier, you can produce more serotonin and that can help people with anxiety, depression, but absolutely there are genetic components towards that that can affect it. There are traumatic events in the past. Mm-hmm. There's, I think it's a very holistic, different group of things why one person can handle such severe trauma and not deal with anxiety, depression. And another person can, to them, what we might look at as more mild trauma and be devastated, So that's, there's a lot of different factors I think that go into understanding.
The awareness is key with what you're doing, I think is important because people do burn out, talking about even just work or, right now you look at all the health workers, all the nurses, just the trauma they're going through. I think we're going to see a big rash of PTSD.
Seeing it already. Absolutely. Some of the first groups that are using our technology are actually in the call centers. It's the number one, you have a lot of volunteers who are on, 911 helplines and that, emergency services. And they hear they're dealing with such intense stressful situations all day long. It's the number one thing is that they all quit. They burn out so quickly. So they're, we can provide a way to pay attention to who needs maybe time off or take a break, sooner or intervene, the workforce, for their own employees' health. It's so beneficial. So in the last 2 years, it's been so interesting to talk to so many, young people and you read about it in the paper when you actually talk to them and hear them say, yes, it has been really hard. It's been so difficult. The last year has been so challenging. It's tough enough being a student, let alone
dealing with
pressures and anxiety. So
how did you handle doing all that you do, as when you were learning and going in residency and going back to your book again too? I mean, it's all connected, right? But how did you handle it to get through the whole journey of becoming a doctor? How did you, it's like you see doctors Red Bulls and coffee, and I'm going, you told us not to do that.
Yeah.
It is funny, right? We are eating the worst food, having
half the people I know that run gyms are the best cocktail drinkers on the planet. They could do shots and they're fine. And I'm like, how did you do that?
The doctors I knew worked hard and partied hard.
I would.
You say, how did you survive that? You had to, vent some steam when you were let out of the hospital finally. So you had all these people who should have gone home and rest. We're off running ultra marathons at 3 a.m. or when you see them at parties dancing, they are the ones that are having the most fun. They really go for it at the parties. But I smiled through it. I mean, I think a lot of medicine, there's a lot of laughter in the ORs. I think everybody realizes it's such a tense situation. Like you said, you mentioned for yourself, you laugh when it gets uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the most human thing is you're in these the hospital is inherently a stressful, tense situation for most people.
Yeah.
Even in the most joyful of happy experiences, let's say delivering a baby, which is still very stressful in so many different ways. And so there is a lot of humor and laughter and support for each other. There is camaraderie. So that, you know, how you get through, I think everybody had their own, some people probably went back to their families. I was single going through that training. I couldn't imagine having been, you know, having to also have a, you know, wife and family and trying to stay awake for them. Cause there were times you just collapsed, and taking care of a dog was challenging at the time.
That's so what Nancy was saying, that you had a dog, a puppy.
Yes. Yes. Winston, the wonder dog. I have a picture somewhere. He was, my girlfriend at the time was a surgeon, so she should know better, but she asked if he had a dog. Set up. I said no. And then she just dropped this 8-week-old puppy on my bed. And that was the most stressful month of my whole residency.
I bet.
Well, it taught you about poop, didn't it?
Oh my goodness.
We're back to the dog poop.
The dog poop and everything else. I think the vet had volumes with him. He was the biggest troublemaker. People used to, I've never read the book Marley and Me, because I know there'll be some sad ending, so I just won't read it. But I mean, he was in trouble all the time. We were in the vet every week with something else, and just this big goofy smile. But yeah.
There are people like that too. There's dogs like that and rabbits like that. There are certain things.
I'll be back to bunnies too.
Yes, animals and people who are somehow just end up always needing to go to a doctor. And then other ones who just don't. I don't know if it's hereditary, but or mind control or whatever, but
I think every doctor would agree with you.
Yeah,
you have a lot of repeat people who seem like I said, they're dealing with deeper issues. They need to come in for different. I mean, sometimes it's very legitimate. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. You have to
hurt yourself again. And we got to treat this. Oh, my goodness. I can't believe, this happened. But other time there definitely are. And certain slices of life, I think you do see it more when you're dealing with, sometimes you need to see them more frequently, but there are certainly patients who they would be coming in all the time and you'd be asking, you'd almost have to set a schedule. Of let's plan on seeing you a month out. Let's give it a month. There's no reason to come back in. They would call you 3 days later.
Are you sure?
Yeah. So it's tough to understand, because you realize, boy, they must be dealing with their own issues, and you can't, as much as you want to laugh it off and say they're fine, they don't need to see me, there was obviously something to them that was very important to.
It's difficult.
We are grappling with it, and to me though, I mean, I have to really break my arm, or something actually has to happen for me to go in. There's no way. I'm not.
Me neither.
I know. No. All I know is, because then it starts. Well, you could be no.
It's like when you take your car to mechanic.
I can say this because
everything else.
You're right though. I can't tell how many people show up saying, I haven't seen a doctor in 60 years, and they're the healthiest people. They're not taking any medicines.
Just, exactly.
But good thing you stayed away. We could have messed you up by now.
Yeah. And I have my wine every night, and it's not going away. Dr. Jackie says 5 ounces, and she knows, though, if we have less than 5 ounces, or it's going to always be more than 5 ounces every night. And if you take that away, we may be a little bit stressful.
We'll be
sick.
I'll tell you, there's some cardiologists and heads of departments I know who will tell people it's a risk factor not to have a glass of wine.
You must have it. So. Mm-hmm. You need to have it.
You can find whatever evidence you want out there. Usually I always tell people, it depends what you want to hear. I can back it up, I'm sure.
I'd rather be chilled out. I would rather be chilled out. However I get there, that's cool with me.
Well, I think nervous stuff, when you get over tense, it does something within your body. Mm-hmm. I think you get ulcers that way, and then you get headaches and all this stuff goes wrong. And if you keep doing that and you get all that tense for so long, then your body goes, screw you, I'm tired of this, I quit. So, I think it's good to have a little libation to relax and to take time off. Vacations are a good thing.
Vacations, taking a walk, exercise, having that glass of wine, if that's what works for you. Everybody, I always say everything in balance.
Yeah. We have a Facebook group, 1 hour walk, #1 hour walk, because it's about when we started our national park journey, people thought let's go hiking, let's go rafting, let's do all this. And then there are people who think you have to be a backpacker to go into parks like that, not realizing there's always something for everyone. If you're in a wheelchair, if you're a kid in a stroller, there's something for you there, and you can take a 1 hour walk anywhere, just slow down, look at the flowers, the butterflies, even if it's your neighborhood. But it's really about getting out there 3 times a week, 1 hour a walk. That's all you need to be happy.
I've heard some really great advice for people, especially dealing with addiction, with anxiety, depression, when they're in there. Their mentors will tell a lot of their, I guess they're not patients. They're more their mentees, I guess. Hey, I know you're having a hard time. Go take a walk, then come back and walk, or go and know, just do that. And just that little bit of exercise can chemically change us, can break that terrible cycle that you can't get out of. So
it goes with the gut health too. How many times, we do have to let a dog out. So, but if you watched a dog finally go poop, and all of a sudden the dog does a backward scratch and jumps around and is all excited.
Yeah, it's like a rabbit. That's true,
because they went walkies and they went poop. And I think there's something about and walking and poop and makes everybody happy.
We did say it would all come back to poop, but in our East West clinic, we're like, hey, if you're not pooping, something's wrong. No wonder you're upset.
Exactly.
Pooping, things are not healthy.
Go walking, get the movement going. All right. Well, listen.
That's the next book. It all comes back to poop.
It all comes back to poop. It does. Yeah. And it's okay. Look at the colors. It's all good. Everyone, Playing Doctor Part 2 Residency, out by John Lawrence Ryder, is out. JohnLawrenceRyder.com is the website, but Dr. John, go keep up with him on his website. And and you're on social media too, right? Facebook and places like that for people.
Yeah, John Lawrence Ryder. I guess that's Instagram. I'm terrible at these things. I need to get more active on them. So thank you for talking about the book today. It's really lovely.
Yeah. Thank you for joining
us. We've
talked
really
about everything, including poop. Thank you. Everyone, again, it's out December 27th, 2021, JohnLawrenceRyder.com. And of course, keep up with us at BigBlendRadio.com. We air daily, except for major holidays, unless we say, let's have an extra glass of wine and do a live broadcast. So there it is.
I'll be here for that one.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Bye.